into a fan. And she's the writer who I am most indebted to and most touched by.
The Left Hand of Darkness.
The Left Hand of Darkness. These are two of her latest books. Late in the Day Poems 2010-2014. No Time to Spare. This is a set of essays from the same period. We don't have here the very latest poetry book that just came in yesterday, I think. But that's okay. Anyway, we'll be having a memorial. It won't but just be me, even though I, in addition to my love for her work, I had the opportunity to meet her a couple of times. We have another local Sebastopol writer, Teresa Dentino, coming, who also took a writing workshop from her. These two guys, big fans, so it's going to be an occasion for expression of love and appreciation. So that's 1 week from tonight. On Thursday, October 4th. Mm-hmm. 2 weeks from tonight, we have Jim back on the center stage again. We're going to be playing, it's going to be a game night, because we had a cancellation of Dominic Shaner, who's going to give a concert, but he couldn't make it, so we will be doing something we've done before, which is a lot of fun. We'll be playing what Jim originally created as Crazy Zen, but is now Crazy Quaker. No.
No.
No, it's called Crazy Eights, I think, is the
Extreme
name.
Extreme Eights.
Oh, I beg your
Extreme
pardon.
Extreme Eights.
I beg your pardon, Extreme Eights. So we'll be doing that.
It'd be game night.
Game night here at Many Rivers. That will be on the 11th, October 11th. I can't believe we're already getting into October already. And then the third Thursday, Dave Rico will be returning. He, as many of you know who've been to his events before, memorably he has recited poems, often at the end, although sometimes during his presentations, by heart, with great skill in many cases. And he'll be talking about poetry again. This is the book that he will be highlighting. It's not a new book. He has a couple of new books coming up, but they're not out yet. So his book-related topic will be Being True to Life, Poetic Paths to Personal Growth. So that will be on the 18th. And 2 days after that, we have our tea tasting for the month on Saturday, October 20th. And that will be Pu'er Teas, which we haven't tasted in a while. And we have some new Pu'ers that just came in, actually, literally today. And so that's upcoming events.
And the last one is...
And then we have one event at the very end of the month. I think it's the 22nd.
Something like that.
Which will be a local Tarot practitioner, Sequoia, who's giving
that'd
a talk.
That'd be the 25th.
And
Thursday.
Intuitive Tarot here for you.
Intuitive Tarot. She gave a presentation... Actually, before, and I was quite impressed. So, is our October lineup.
Are these on the website?
No, not yet.
Okay.
As of tomorrow, they'll be on Facebook.
All right. So there you go. Which is really all you need in life.
Oh yeah.
Send me
all of life.
Yes.
Send me the stuff so I can.
Yeah. So. I'm going to just put this over here. Are you going to be using the bell?
Uh-huh.
Okay. I'll put it over here if you don't mind.
I don't mind.
I am happy to hear it. So, many of you know that I have known Jim, oh my goodness, let's think about this, very short of 40 years. Of course, he's one of the co-founders of Stuart and myself of this store. He has helped us with a number of projects, spiritual, etc. projects in the past. I'm very much looking forward to hearing about his thoughts about the contemporary challenges, the unique new contemporary challenges to the mystical way. So please join me in welcoming my good friend Jim Wilson.
Thank you. It's wonderful to see you tonight. Let's start out with just a few minutes of silent contemplation. Coming into the world empty-handed, leaving the world empty-handed. That is the human way. When you are born, where do you come from? When you die, where do you go? Life is like a cloud appearing. Death is like a cloud disappearing. Originally, the cloud itself does not exist. But there is one thing that always remains pure and clear. It is not dependent upon life or death. What is the one pure and clear thing? So tonight we have a nice small group here, and everybody I think knows me, and feel free to, if you have questions or something like that. So what I want to talk about today is the topic of mysticism and the particular difficulties accessing the mystical path in the term I'm going to use is modernity, you know, like in the contemporary situation, you know, like, because I think there are aspects of our contemporary culture which either didn't exist in the past or they didn't exist to the degree that they do now, and make it more difficult to. And in order to talk about that, I'd like to stick my neck way out and define mysticism. Because otherwise, you know, like, we'll kind of be floundering around about why it's difficult. So when I use the term mysticism, I mean it is a shifting of attention from the ephemeral to the eternal. So you're shifting your awareness or your attention from that which is ephemeral to that which is eternal. Or you can say you're shifting your attention from the impermanent to that which always exists. Or from the sensory to the non-sensory. Or from present appearance, sensory appearance, to the transcendental. So the main one I like is from the ephemeral to the eternal. You're shifting your attention. So, why is that difficult to do? So, that which always exists, it has no form, and it has no content. Because, look at it this way, if you hear the sound of a bell, and the sound appears, and then the sound disappears, so it's not eternal. The sound of the bell is not eternal. So. And that's true of all sounds. Right? And that's also true of all visual things. Everything we see appears and disappears. Everything we hear appears and disappears. Everything odors appear and disappear. Everything we touch, and everything in our consciousness appears and disappears as well. Feelings, impulses, thoughts, they arise and they disappear in exactly the same way as the sound of a bell. So if that which is eternal was a sound, it would not be eternal, because sounds appear and disappear. If that which is eternal had a color, it would also appear and disappear. So that which is eternal has no form. My teacher used to say it's like before name and form. That was the expression. So you can think of mysticism as a path, and this is a metaphor. Mysticism Avenue, but you can think of it as a path. That movement from being attentive to the ephemeral to being attentive to the eternal, there is a path that one takes in order to accomplish that. And this shift of attention, you can see it in many, many different traditions. And they use different vocabularies as a name for that which is eternal, But actually, it doesn't have a name. One way you can look at it is that which is you can look at it as like concentric circles. So the eternal at the center, it has no name, it has no form, and then immediately around that is the first concentric circle, and those are the first names you can use to talk about that. But ultimately, those names are not accurate. I wouldn't say they're inaccurate, but they're not. It's not like saying an apple is red or an apple is green or something like that. The phrase that a mystical writer from very early Christianity used to describe these names is, he said, they are next to it, but not it. So as long as you keep that in mind, that it's next to it and not it itself, that's not really a problem. But often people do kind of get attached to that next to domain, and they,
I have a question. Could you say that, sometimes the analogy of like the taste of a steak is not the experience of tasting a steak, because is the word steak next to the experience in the way that you're describing it? Or sorry, that's right, you're vegan now, so that's a bad example. The taste of a rutabaga.
A vegan is a missed steak.
How close
The practical question I have is, yeah. Is there something distinguished about a description of the mystical that's close to, that's different than any other name or form?
I understand that, and there's actually a lot written about that, you know, like...
Including by yourself.
Yeah. I mean, in the Platonic mystical tradition, the names they use are the good, the beautiful, and the one. The good, the beautiful, and the one. You know? In many traditions, they refer to it as the light. You know, like, and in the Taoist tradition, it's actually that which can contain both the light and the dark, which is symbolized by the yin-yang mandala. So the Tao is that which is the name even before the yin-yang symbol. The Tao contains both of those. Right? So you do get different patterns of naming. You know, like,
so could you say in a sense, yeah, that the name acts much like a lens does with light, so the name kind of focuses our attention, mm-hmm, in a domain, and so in and of itself it's not the thing that's it's not the domain itself, but it does serve as a focusing,
yes,
mechanism.
Yes, it's one way you can look at the path to the mystical path is a divine ascent or a ladder of ascent. That's a metaphor that is used quite frequently. In fact, there are whole books which use the ladder metaphor. You know, like, and what you're doing is you're climbing closer and closer and closer and closer to the ultimate. You know, like, and some things are quite distant from it. You know, like, and other things are closer. So, I mean, on this issue, my man Dionysus the Areopagite, he's very articulate. he wrote a number of treatises, and his treatise, Mystical Theology, is foundational for Western mysticism. And it's quite short. It's only about 5 or 6 pages long. So, and it's in 5 sections, and this is the 5th section. Okay. So, again, as we climb higher, we say this: it is not soul or mind, nor does it possess imagination, conviction, speech, or understanding. Nor is it speech per se or understanding per se. It cannot be spoken of, and it cannot be grasped by the understanding. It is not number or order. So in the West, that was very important, that it's not number. Number was a big candidate for, you know. It is not number or order, greatness or smallness, equality or inequality, similarity or dissimilarity. It is not immovable. It is not moving. It is not at rest. It has no power. It is not power. It is not light. It does not live, nor is it life. It is not substance. It is not eternity, and it is not time. It cannot be grasped by the understanding, since it is neither knowledge nor truth. It is not kingship. It is not wisdom. It is neither one nor oneness, divinity nor goodness, nor is it a spirit in the sense in which we understand that term. It is not sonship or fatherhood. What he's doing is he's negating the Trinity here. It is not sonship or fatherhood. It is nothing known to us or to any being. It falls neither within the predicate of non-being nor being. Existing beings do not know it as it actually is, and it does not know them as they are. There is no speaking of it, nor name, nor knowledge of it. Darkness and light, error and truth, it is none of these. It is beyond assertion and denial. We make assertions and denials of what is next to it, but never of it, for it is both beyond every assertion. being perfect and unique, being the perfect and unique cause of all things, and by virtue of its preeminently simple and absolute nature, free of every limitation, beyond every limitation, and it is also beyond every denial. So there you go. Ready?
It has power.
He says somewhere that it doesn't have power. So, I wrote a whole commentary on the mystical theology where I compared the mystical theology to the Heart Sutra, because the comparison I was making is that in the Heart Sutra, the Heart Sutra negates the foundational truths of the Buddha Dharma, such as the Four Noble Truths. Like those are negated. And here in this section, and in the previous section as well, Dionysus negates the foundational understandings of the Christian tradition. So you can see a similarity if you're familiar with the Heart Sutra, which I know some people here are. And so, let's see.
I have a comment. So, Christian teaching basically says that what you're talking about, that aspect of God or God the Father, is unknowable. So, if that's true, then really it has little to do with mysticism. Because what is knowable is the divine energies of God. Those are knowable.
Mm-hmm.
So the mystical way really is associated with the divine energies, which would be a lot of the aspects that you were talking about, say the light,
mm-hmm.
or even the sound, for example. In mm-hmm. the Gospels, when the Holy Spirit showed up, there was a violent sound.
Right.
So the even sound, those are divine energies. So that's the mystical way is more associated with those, because God the Father or the Absolute is hopelessly beyond us forever.
Mm-hmm. Except through grace.
Well, at least according to Dionysius, I don't think that part of God is ever accessible.
All right. I have a different perspective on that, and I'd like to bracket that issue at the moment. And I understand what you're saying, and it makes sense to me. My view, it's an interesting issue, and I've seen that issue raised in various ways in different spiritual contexts, and it's my view that it actually is possible to ascend into that domain. But I could be wrong. So that's my basic view about what mysticism is. It's that shift of attention, and you take a journey, to be attentive to that which is eternal, to that which always exists, as my teacher says, to the one thing which is always pure and clear and not dependent on life or death. So what I'd like to talk about now is the obstacles to entering into that path, the blockages or the difficulties in the world today to doing that. One of them is we live in a time when we believe that only that which is available to the senses exists. Okay. So, and this is very widespread. This is a very widespread understanding. In modernity, that only that, abstractions such as numbers and things like that are reconfigured as epiphenomenon. They don't have a reality unto themselves, so that So you can't ascend through abstractions toward the one. You know, like, the idea here is that the existence of a transcendental is negated in modernity, and this is quite recent. This is, but we're so steeped in this view that it's hard for us to realize how unique our situation is. In fact, our culture at this time is the only one in the history of humanity that has that point of view.
When was this negated? When was this negation?
Well, I would say it begins in the... it really makes its presence felt in the 17th century, you know, like, and then it really builds up steam from there, you know, like, there's a complex history. A lot of it had to do with the Reformation and a shift to the dueling parties in the Reformation. We're very committed to reason, you know, like, and theology became an extremely rationalistic project, you know, like, a lot of it had to do with that. And then, of course, the movement of science and economic rationality and the needs of production, and all of that, you know, converged to create a situation where even the idea of Never mind the ultimate one, never mind the energies, people don't believe that there's any such thing as an actually existing abstraction or transcendental. For example, in the West, it was the norm that numbers were considered to be real things. Like that, you know, and that they were abstractions existing in what were called a Platonic dimension of reality, you know, like, and so in other words, mathematicians discovered numbers and their relationships. They didn't create numbers and their relationships; they discovered them, you know, like, and so if you have that as a pervasive understanding, there's kind of a foundation for the stepping beyond the sensory, like, in. And there are many other. For example, it was very widely believed that the same applied to ethical understandings, that we discovered ethics, you know, which existed in a transcendental dimension. You know, like, that we didn't, the human beings didn't create good and bad. You know, that we discovered good and bad. It's actually quite hard to find people today who would go along with that. You know, they would say, oh, you know, today is, you know, what's good for you is good for you, what's good for me is good for me. You know, like, that's very recent. That's extremely recent. And yet it's pervasive. You know, like, so my answer, when I discuss this with people, what I try and do is say, you know, it's really interesting because we use non-sensory objects all the time, every day. And you don't have to go for energies or principalities or numbers or things like that. Just things like and, or, in between, you know, like, yeah, very, very ordinary things. I mean, you can't...
Money.
there are all sorts of, once you become aware of it, it's really quite remarkable, you know, the people who use these kinds of abstractions, these objects, and they are objects because they have impact in the world, you know, like, they have effects in the world, you know, like, once you become attuned to it, you see people and hear people using them all the time, constantly. But they're, in a way, because we use them so much and so frequently, we're not attuned to them. So, you know, I think in modernity we need to take baby steps and first of all become aware of how often we use these objects. Now, some, in fact many today, scientists and contemporary philosophers would give material explanations for concepts like and, or, in between, to the right of, you know, like all those kinds of things. That's okay. They are still non-material realities. You don't have to challenge that kind of assumption. You don't have to get into that kind of issue. You're still using abstract entities that have no color, that have no weight, that have no dimensions. You know, like and is not, you know, like 3 by 6 by 9. You know, like or you know, like that kind of thing. And yet, these are extremely powerful non-sensory realities. You know, like, if these non-sensory realities arise, you know, from material conditions, that's okay. You know, like, that's a separate issue. This is what I'm getting at. The idea is to become aware that they do exist and that we do use them. You know, like, all the time. You know, without, I mean, we use them very easily, you know, like, and, but we're not aware that we are using them. To me, that's the first step in kind of pulling away from this fixation on the sensory domain, you know, like that the sensory domain is all that we experience. We aren't only experiencing the sense domain. Does that make sense? Or?
Right. Are you saying that and but represent something?
Yes.
Is it like a connection? I mean, I would think the and or the but is a connection.
You can look at it that way, and that's a way of explaining. You can also
spatially explain.
Right, and many people do explain them that way, and it's an efficacious explanation. But you can also look at them as forms or organizing principles which hold the world together. In other words, they actually exist before objects exist.
So I have a question. You spoke of transcendence, and it's my observation that a lot of modern philosophical thought, even materialist thought, particularly from people who are given to Buddhist sensibilities but still have a kind of a materialist worldview, mm-hmm. Locate transcendence in the realization of the inherent emptiness of these very uh-huh. abstractions that you're describing. And so for them, transcendence is to see, you know, self as a construct, to see cars mm-hmm. as a construct, to mm-hmm. see money as a construct, that arises from conditions but has no inherent reality. And so I guess, just so I understand the position that you're staking out, are you asserting a more Platonic view that there's inherent essential reality to these abstractions that then ingress on the material realm and we see their consequences? Or are you sharing the notion of transcendence with this interpretation of Buddhism that I've described, which says that these things don't have inherent reality, but they arise like clouds, as you were describing
right.
earlier.
I go back and forth on that issue. You know, like
that would be like the perfect balance, wouldn't it?
I mean.
because ultimately change is the only real thing. Right?
Now there are eternal objects. I'm committing myself to eternal objects.
I'm yeah, busted. But
at this time.
Thank you.
All right. But I love having these kinds of discussions. But I don't think moving from the ephemeral to the eternal is dependent upon the position you stake out in that domain. You know, so whether you're a Platonist or whether you're a madhyamaka, mm-hmm. you know, like, you can still make that shift of attention, you know,
yes.
like, and so
well,
that's kind of where I am about.
So that
about
that would suggest then that the distinctions that we're drawing between an eternalist or a Platonist and a madhyamakist would be still located in a sense in the conceptual. And it's not
yeah,
that.
I would say those kinds of things are not the first concentric circle after
okay.
the ultimate. I would say it would be more like the second or the
third.
So
there's something beyond that distinction that
mm-hmm.
Is where you're directing our attention.
Yeah. So, you know, the just becoming aware of how often we use these kinds of non-sensory experiences is, it's kind of liberating, actually. You know, like, just to turn your attention, you know, like, to that. What does it liberate you from? It liberates you from the pervasive cultural understanding that we have today that realm does not exist. That only sensory experience is real. So I would say that's perhaps the biggest obstacle to entering into the mystic path. Another one is I like to call it hyper individualism. Our culture is famous for being individualistic, and the particular way I describe it is hyper-individualism. And what I mean by that is there's kind of an idea that the purpose of life is to, as much as possible, bend the world to our likes and dislikes. That's the purpose. That is to acquire possessions that we like, to get rid of possessions that we don't like, to configure things along those lines. And advertising is a huge generator of this belief. And we're all influenced by that. But the mystical way requires that we conform to a path that will lead us to the ultimate. And it's not an individual path. It's not something that we create, and it's not something that we acquire. And so that can be felt as limiting or annoying, or why can't I become a mystic on my own terms, that. So there's a kind of a psychology here, that keeps us very, very much centered. So, for example, in the Quaker Manual for Contemplation, A Guide to Two Peace. See if I can find the passage. We must retire from all outward objects and silence all the desires and wandering imaginations of the mind, that in this profound silence of the whole soul we may hearken to the ineffable voice of the divine teacher. Voice.
Well, that's actually kind of where I was been sitting here thinking what you just said there, because my understanding of the mystical way is that, and that it's actually a shutting out of the sensory
mm-hmm.
and a stopping of the mind,
mm-hmm.
and it's more of awareness, and it's just simply, and then it's an infusion. It's not something that we acquire. It's something that's bestowed on us.
That's the same view. That's
yeah.
exactly the same view.
Yeah. So the first step is to just quiet the mind and,
it's coming
and
up.
Kind of exit this planet. You're here, but really not.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's what some people called empty-headed Quakerism.
Empty-headed Quakerism,
okay.
Right.
That's what the evangelicals called it.
Yep.
And the traditionalists called it, turned back on them and said, you're just trying to turn it into a salvation machine.
Yeah. So as long as we're, you know, I mean, the Guide to Two Peace talks a lot, not just there, but talks a lot about setting aside one's personal inclinations, you know, like, and one's personal likes and dislikes. But if you believe, if you're a hyper-individualist, then your identity is very, very strongly bound up with shaping things according to your own agenda, you know, like, and so that creates a barrier to setting aside all the desires and wandering imaginations of the mind. You know, like, there's a kind of a friction there. Now, I think human beings have, I think that's been a problem for human beings always. You know, like, here, I think in this particular case, we're talking about a matter of degree. You know, like, so here's a little example of what I mean by a matter of degree. The Japanese have taken census of their plural of census is censuses, since for many centuries they've had census, right? And for a very long time, and until very, very recently they counted households. They did not count individuals, you know. They counted households, you know, like, so, you know, like, so that's a very different way of looking at your place in society, you know, like, so they would go to a household. Part of the reason for the census had to do with the distribution of funds to various temples, you know, like, and so what they would want to know, how many households does this temple serve? They didn't want to know how many individuals the temple served, like so. And that was true in Japan until after World War II, when the occupation changed their method of doing this kind of thing, you know, like so. And that's just one example, you know, like, I mean, of that kind of shift, like we say, a shift in degree, you know, like a Chinese friend of mine used to say that in Confucianism, if the hand represents the family, then you're just this little digit, you know, like, and the whole family is working and moving forward, and you just, you know, one little thing on that. But that isn't how we look at it at all. You know, we do not look at things that way, and I think that creates a peculiar obstacle to entering into the mystical way. Because it creates a barrier to conforming oneself to the way, to the one. You know, like, so.
You have no experience of conforming to something larger.
Right.
Right.
There's this dream that we have of peace.
Yes.
And it's been there since the first people became cognizant of reality.
Yes.
We are aware of something greater than ourselves, and if we pull ourselves closer to it, we can live it out.
Yes. No argument here. I think all human beings have the capacity to awaken to this, but part of what I'm trying to do is, in order to enter into the mystical way, we need to become aware of our situation. Mm-hmm. You know, like, and what are the obstacles to understanding at this time in our culture? You know, like, and I believe there are certain aspects of our culture which are peculiar to our culture, like the first one I mentioned. We are the only culture that has ever existed which argues that only sensory experience is real. You know, like, no other culture. Now, it's possible that all other cultures in existence were wrong. Yeah. It is. They might have been. But it's worth considering, you know, like, that maybe we have a blind spot. Maybe it's we who have a blind spot about that. You know, like, so, I mean, even, for example, nature spirits or angels or, you know, these kinds of... these are not... I'm not talking about the one, but this kind of interaction with that dimension is dismissed today as disordered, you know, like, or it's marginalized. And we don't have any methodology today to, like, sift what's genuine from what's not genuine when people, you know, make claims like that, because it's been shoved to the side so much. You know, like, so that's part of what I'm referring to. You know.
Is that related, do you think, to the propertarian view that you've been pointing to? You can't own a spirit, a non-material spirit. You can't claim it as property. You can't claim it as, that's mine, or that's yours, or something like that.
I hadn't thought of that connection, but I like that intuitively. That makes sense to me. You know, like, I mean,
because as I was listening to you speaking about this hyper individualism, the thing that struck me about it was, in fact, Stuart and I have a little joke between us. We used to have a practitioner who, when his son would come over and he was like 2 to 4 years old, the son would, he was now 22 or something. He would come to the house and he would point something and he'd say, "Mine, mine,"
right.
And he was very aggressive in these assertions. And I think the feedback he got from people was that was cute but not inappropriate.
Right.
You know, so that relationship of ownership, mm-hmm. whether it's mine or someone else's. It strikes me. It was just striking me as I was listening to you. And then you mentioned these non-material mm-hmm. Assertions that, mm-hmm. that people make. You know, I can't own Galadriel, and I can't own whoever.
Right.
You know.
But you can own a point of view. You can own a belief system, and
well, not exclusively.
No, but people relate.
You could copyright the book where you put it.
You could, but people relate to those things in much the same way mm-hmm. when their beliefs are threatened. That mm-hmm. There's a physical threat.
Mm-hmm. That's true.
So. Another aspect of modernity, which I think is worth considering as an obstacle to entering the mystic way, is psychology. All right. And this is tricky because I'm not saying psychology is bad. You know, like, I've been to a therapist, you know, like, more than once, and benefited, you know, like, from that interaction. But it's also important to highlight that early psychology was very hostile to transcendental realities. Freud was enormously hostile, you know, like Moses and monotheism, the future of a delusion, is it an illusion? I can't remember. It's either future of a delusion or future of an illusion. And Marxism, you know, like, regarded, you know, like, all systems of spirituality as the opiates of the masses, you know, like, and when I say all, I mean all, you know, like, Chinese communism was just as brutal to Buddhism as Russian communism was to Christianity, you know, like, and so, and the influence of that, you actually see that influence of psychology in the way that Eastern traditions have been reconfigured in the West when they been brought into the West. There's a kind of a battle going on. It isn't always explicit, but often the technologies from the East are taken into the West and they're reinterpreted as modalities for making your life more pleasant, you know, like, or making you more beautiful. You know, like, there are, I mean, one example is the way yoga is presented as a health regimen, you know, like, and there are more than a few gyms which include yoga sessions. And I'm not even saying that that's bad. What I'm saying is that the idea that yoga is a path of renunciation and that yoga is a method for setting aside all the likes and dislikes of the mind, that is fragile in the West. And I believe the reason it's fragile is because of this permeating presence of these kinds of thought systems like psychology and Marxist influence.
Chinese have always approached the general population of Chinese has always approached Buddhism as a way of buying luck.
Yes.
And so, and that was their form of self-improvement. And so,
fair enough. Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, I get that. Yeah.
You see what I'm driving at?
I do.
I mean, using spiritual methods to improve the quality of life, or, you know,
uh-huh.
whether it's beauty or fitness or uh-huh. wealth or whatever.
It's not exactly new.
Not exactly new.
Yeah. Fair enough. That's a good point. You know, like, but because we grow up immersed in these kinds of interpretations, it's hard for us to see through them.
Yeah, well, I would amend your point here to saying that to that point that it's difficult. I think that the obstacle is that it's difficult for people to imagine a transcendent
uh-huh.
quality.
Right.
Because they're so immersed in the improvement. Whereas in earlier societies, the transcendent quality was a given,
mm-hmm.
even if you exploited it for other purposes.
Right. Right. Thank you. Yeah. That's one of the things which happens with psychology is many of the methodologies for walking the mystical way involve things like renunciation and asceticism. I'm talking about the traditional ways. And one of the things psychology does contemporaneously is to reinterpret that impulse as a neurosis. Mm. You know, like, and instead of, which, to be fair, at times it is. You know, like, so, but it kind of, if someone is a little tentative and unsure and they feel the pull of the eternal, you know, like, and they want to pull away from the sensory, but they're not very articulate, the power of reinterpreting that pull as a neurosis can be harmful, you know, like, to the journey. And, yeah. And needs to be understood for what it is.
Yeah, I that's kind of along the lines that I was thinking, because I was sitting here thinking about, wondering if you were going to bring up concepts like purification,
uh-huh.
purity, or, so for example, that's central in my understanding of
uh-huh.
of any kind of mystical
mm-hmm.
path, is the idea behind if is. For me, is to understand that God or the Absolute or whatever you want to call it is holy, pure, and good, and any kind of connection that we are ever to have with that holy, pure, good God, loving God, is only can be if we become like Him.
Yes.
So if we're not like Him, that's why people don't have connections, because their life is so far from the realities of God's existence and who He is, that there isn't much. It's kind of like He doesn't really, He wants to hang out with buddies who are like Him. I mean, that's the way kind of I like to put it. And so the closer someone, I'm getting back to what you just said, so the closer someone gets to being, manifesting those traits of goodness and holiness and love and all those things, then there's an inner drawing, like you were just talking about, a compulsion to go into that place of oneness where there's a connection, it's a drawing that happens.
Beautifully put. Thank you. Thank you.
Was it God that commanded the Old Testament wars?
I'd like to bracket that for a while. I really don't want to go there right now.
Jesus says we're supposed to love our enemies.
Right.
The Apostle Paul sort of has fun with that and says, uh-huh. Love your enemies, for in so doing, you will heap coals of fire upon them.
One of your favorite passages.
Absolutely. I need help understanding.
Yes. Yes.
That's why I'm here.
Thank you. Thank you. So, let's see, I'm running out of time, but I do want to say, I have two more things to say. One is that modernity actually presents some opportunities for us. You know, like, it's not just that it has these barriers, you know, like, there are also opportunities, and one of the opportunities it has is that with our vast acquaintance, I mean, you know, like, I can quote a passage from the Tao Te Ching about close the senses, go within, and compare that to Dionysus, and compare Dionysus to the Heart Sutra. When in history, you know, like, have we been able to do that? And that offers us an opportunity to see beyond a, how do I put it, to free ourselves from a specifically embedded mode of mysticism. You know, like, that's both a plus and a minus, because we're kind of at loose ends, but the truth is, that's our situation. You know, like, we are at loose ends. Incidentally, I'm not saying that the traditional modes aren't still useful. They are useful. You know, like, and I have a huge amount of respect and admiration, you know, for these traditionals. But our traditional modes, we can take advantage of this situation. You know, like, this cross fertilization. You know, like, and it actually can lift us up out of, it can free us from an attachment to a particular historical dimension, even while using it. You know, like, and that can be a considerable benefit. You know, like, I mean, I look at my own journey. I refer to myself as the great wanderer. You know, like, it's just, you know, like, I can never remember what hexagram it is, but if you want to know about Jim, find the hexagram in the I Ching, the Wanderer. You know, like, so you know, like, I've been through quite a number of traditions, and I have no regrets about it. You know, like, it's actually, you know, like, I mean, sometimes I do have regrets about it, to be honest with you. You know, like, but when I look at, when I have some equanimity, I can see how all of it has contributed to my journey. All of it has nourished me. You know, like, and so that can be the case. You know, like, so I'd like to close with a few suggestions about how to enter the path, the mystic path. Just a few suggestions. I like it. I realize this is, I'm going very, very rapidly, and I apologize for that. But I should do a 5-year seminar or something like that. One of the suggestions I have for entering the path is to study impermanence. I really, really mean study impermanence. I really mean it. You know, like, and contemplate it, study it, really take it to heart. There's a whole series of contemplations that many traditions have developed, but everything is like the sound of a bell. Everything arises and disappears like the sound of a bell. You know, like everything we see, everything we touch, everything we think about, everything we feel arises and disappears like the sound of a bell. You know, like, and not just that, all of our institutions, nations come and go like leaves in the wind. You know, like
cells in our body.
And the cells in our body. You know, like, but why do we need to study it? Why do we need to contemplate it? Because appearances are deceptive. Okay? So when I look at the objects in this room, they don't appear to be changing to me. That, you know, like that shelf there looks quite stable. You know, like that shelf is not telling me that it's impermanent. I have to, from a visual perspective, I have to infer that it's impermanent. And that's why study and contemplation of impermanence is necessary. Very important.
This is another reason also that our biological and social conditioning is to see things as permanent.
Yes, absolutely. But if you pursue study of impermanence, I would suggest that you do it with other people, because given today's philosophical and what I call the configuration of modernity, such a study can lead to nihilism. That nothing matters, everything is going to disappear. And it's really quite important to be with other people, or to have a good teacher, to deflect that conclusion. Yeah.
So my own view would be that one of the ways to study impermanence, as you just suggested, is actually to examine that shelf, not as something that our eyes pass over once and draw conclusions about. I mean, the thing that I liked about what you said tonight is this realm of the abstract. And I question the linkage between the abstractness of the products of our mind to the sensory realm in quite the way that you're suggesting. Mm-hmm. So yeah, if I look at I see a blue cup right above you, and it's true that from here it doesn't look like it's changing. On the other hand, I've had lots of experience with these shelves, those cups, and because of that, I know there's probably little bits of tape on those shelves that I've applied and then partially removed over the years. In other words, it's a familiarity with the sensory reality is one way to study. That's what I'm suggesting, is one way to study impermanence in the way that you're advocating.
Granted. That's good. Thank you. I appreciate that. That makes sense to me. Another suggestion I would make, and this will help in overcoming nihilism, is to contemplate beauty.
How lovely.
So the view that I'm suggesting for your consideration is that beauty is a sign of the presence of the transcendent. The reason there is beauty in the world is because everything is connected to the transcendental, is touched by it. That's why beautiful things are beautiful. Right. And so in Plotinus's essay on beauty, he actually has a contemplation that he suggests people engage in. And I've done it. It's really quite remarkable. If you so I'll offer it to you. He suggests taking three beautiful objects, and the examples he gives are a stone, a beautiful house, and a beautiful person. I actually think a beautiful person is not the best, because beautiful people are distracting in a kind of attachment way, but. If it works, it works. You know, like I tend to use a beautiful melody, like a beautiful landscape, and then sometimes a beautiful poem, sometimes a beautiful rock, or something like that. Then contemplate them, and then shift your mind to the beautiful itself. Not the beauty of the rock, or the beauty of the melody, or the beauty of the house, or the beauty of the person, but try and enter into the beautiful itself, that which all of them are sharing and makes them beautiful. It's quite a remarkable experience when you do this. You know, there's a kind of a feeling of actually rising, you know, like, and this opens the gate to beauty as the presence of the divine in the world. But even if you don't enter into that formal contemplation, for me, taking a walk in Armstrong Woods opens that door. Very clearly for me, it's a gateway for me to that presence, several people touched on contemplation, the passage I read in A Guide to True Peace, and the paraphrase I did of the Tao Te Ching. If you contemplation is the withdrawing of the senses into the self, letting all the thoughts and wandering imaginations of the mind go, settling the mind. And then it's what Quakers call waiting worship. And then you are simply in this state of waiting. And it's like waiting for a sunrise before we had timepieces. You know, you could go on the internet and know that the sunrise will be at 6:46 or 5:46. You know, like before technology, if you wanted to see the sunrise, you had to get up early and wait for it to rise.
Is it like waiting for Godot?
It's like waiting for Godot. Just like. This is the image, incidentally, that Plotinus uses for contemplation. Mm. It's a beautiful passage he has in his... it doesn't matter. The location doesn't matter. But he says that you're settling yourself, you're entering into a non-agitated state of mind, and then you wait for the sun to rise. And this waiting is significant because it touches on what you said earlier, that there's an infusion that takes place, but you can't determine, when that's going to happen. I call it grace. I call this infusion grace. And sometimes you might wait and it won't happen, and that's fine. You know, like, it's not a problem. You know, like, and sometimes that sense of presence will suffuse you completely. You know, like, and that's wonderful too. But that doesn't mean it's going to happen the next time you enter into this contemplation. You know, like, and once again, it's very good to have friends. You know, like, who are doing this. It's really good to check in with friends. You know, there are, you can find friends, like, capital friends, capital F friends. So those are a few suggestions. You know, the and part of what I said, I realized, was a little abstract, but that's a tendency of mine. But I was just, I think being aware of the cultural situation that we're in is helpful. You know, to be consciously aware that, oh, you know, like, this is how things are configured at this time. And the reason, one of the reasons I think it's important is because I think some of these things are unique to our time and place. So that if you go into ancient literature and they talk about difficulties in meditation, they aren't going to touch on some of these things that are peculiar to our culture at this time. And that may leave us feeling a little bewildered, you know, like, you know, because they aren't addressing, you know, like, they aren't addressing hyper-individualism, for example, because they weren't hyper-individualist. Like, so you're not going to get, like, information about how to deal with that from these ancient sources. You'll get a lot of assistance from ancient sources, don't misunderstand me, but the obstacles that are peculiar to our time and place, we have to negotiate those. We have to find our way through it. I think we can. You know, I'm confident that we can. And then when we negotiate and find our way through, we can leave our understanding for people in the future and assist them so that their journey can be a little easier. Closing comments or questions? Or?
Oh, thank you, Jim.
You are welcome. My pleasure. Thank you for coming. I appreciate it.
And of course, you know that we have a donation bowl over there. We have some of Jim's work, mystical or or non-esoteric or whatever, poetic, et cetera. So please do check those out. And thank you so much for coming tonight. And please do join us again for future such events.
Thank you,
Rob. Thank you, Jim.